We have the second of three oral arguments. Next, file A, 230659, James Kevin Obawa, petitioner appellant versus Commissioner of Public Safety, the respondent. A230659 is the file number, and as counsel approach and settle in, reminder that we do ask that you identify yourself for the record when you approach the podium. We are recording the proceeding, and so that helps with that part of the record as well. The recording will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may approach and proceed. Thank you.
Just telling counsel I may have picked the wrong week to wean myself off of my allergy medications for the season, so my apologies for the throat clearing, and if I fall asleep, don't take it personally.
We won't, but we might end your part of the hearing if that happens.
Okay, fair enough. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jeff Sheridan. I'm the attorney for the appellant in this case, James Obawa. I appear today, counsel advises me, for the eighth time or seventh time before yet another panel of this court to talk about the inconvenient truth that in the post-McNeely world that roadside sobriety tests are done without a warrant, are presumed to be unreasonable unless the state has established an accepted exception to the warrant requirement to conduct those searches. This matter is before the court on Mr. Obawa's implied consent petition. The court ruled against Mr. Obawa after finding that the evidence from a unwarranted horizontal gaze nystagmus test crossed the threshold from the officer having evidence that Mr. Obawa had consumed alcohol before driving to Mr. Obawa had consumed an illegal amount of alcohol before driving, that he was either under the influence or over the legal limit.
Counsel, I guess I have an initial question, which is, you know, this panel is bound by precedential decisions of other panels of this court. And do you have any case law or precedent that would give us the power to overrule a prior precedential decision of a different panel?
Sure, and I suspect you're talking about the Vondracek decision.
Correct.
I would indicate to the court that you are, when you took your black robe, vowed to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of Minnesota. We'll talk a little bit about Vondracek in a moment, but in that oath, if what you're saying is that you have no ability to depart from what another panel of this court has said, then you reading that
decision... Well, I think the case law would say that's the way that we operate as a court, is if another panel has issued a precedential decision, then we are bound to follow that under our case law.
And I would disagree. I think your oath is to, if you find that decision does not, in fact, comport with your oath, your oath is not to protect and defend the reputation of your colleagues on the court. Your job is to do what the Constitution requires. And so just to assist in that process, we could talk a little bit about...
Can you cite any cases where our panel has, or where a different panel has done that in the history of our court, where it's a constitutional question, we have created essentially a circuit split within our own court?
Right. And that's the analogy, is that there are circuit splits, and that's what it causes the higher courts to accept cases for further review, which our Supreme Court has the ability to do here if it finds that two panels have arrived at two opposite conclusions. This is not a superior court. Their decision is not binding because they are a superior court to you. You are another panel of that exact same court. And so you are not required to do what they say. But that's especially true in the case of Vondracek, and let me explain briefly why that is the case.
Just to clarify, when you started out by saying the officer gave an improper, I can't remember the adjective you used, HGN, that's only in the prospective world that we agree with you, and but not in the current world under Vondracek and the way the officer was trained. You're not making a separate argument. I didn't see that there was a lack of articulable suspicion of driving while impaired, hence the HDN was done.
Right. I said unwarranted, and I didn't mean that in the, it wasn't justified, and I meant it in there was no warrant.
Okay, thank you.
Excuse me.
Going back to Judge Peter's question, just to clarify, if we were to apply the standard under Vondracek, which is reasonable articulable suspicion would support an HDN, would you agree that the facts of this case demonstrate there was reasonable articulable suspicion given the slurred speech, the water, the acknowledgement of drinking, the smelling of alcohol on the breath, and I think watering eyes, if I'm remembering correctly.
I'm not making the argument that that was insufficient.
Okay.
Right? It was the bridge too far was the field sobriety test. In order to get around the inconvenient truth that in the post-McNeely world, even DWI investigations have to be conducted within the confines of the Fourth Amendment, the Vondracek panel decided to attack the question of whether these were even searches in the first place. They did that in a single paragraph in their opinion. It's only a few sentences long, so I think it's worth us going through. And they're saying, first, we consider the contention that roadside field sobriety tests are searches for Fourth Amendment purposes. Such roadside tests differ in significant ways for what is ordinarily considered a search. Searches generally involve the collection of some physical evidence. So the searches that the Fourth Amendment addresses are stuff. That's their position. And in support of that, they said the 1928 case of Olmstead versus United States. Even a rudimentary, what I would refer to as shepherdizing, but I think it has other names these days, but site-checking that, you would quickly arrive at the conclusion. I just touch on it here on my iPad, and it will take me off to Olmstead, which is a case that has a big red flag next to it, and the red flag, of course, tells us that in 1967, Olmstead was overruled in the case of Katz versus the United States. Katz, you may recall, is eavesdropping on somebody who's in a phone booth, obviously not a search for stuff, and so the Olmstead definition of what the Fourth Amendment protects is gone. So we start their whole analysis in, excuse me, in Vondracek with a case that has been overruled by the United States Supreme Court.
Mr. Sheridan, can I clarify, and I was just looking back at your brief, you made the argument, I think you were counsel for Mr. Vondracek, is that?
I was indeed Mr. Vondracek's attorney.
So maybe that's one of the number of times.
One of the numbers,
okay.
Yes.
It looks like you were arguing only the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it looks to be what you're arguing here. You're not arguing separately under the Minnesota Constitution.
I don't think I need to get there, and the reason I didn't go there is because Missouri versus McNeely is a question is a case about the Fourth Amendment, and McNeely, when you ask, well, how can we ignore a binding precedent in the form of Vondracek? My argument would be, how can you avoid binding precedent in the form of Missouri versus McNeely?
Well, but in Vondracek, this court addressed McNeely, and that decision postdates McNeely. And then there was a PFR in Vondracek,
yes.
And the Supreme Court denied review.
Just think how quickly they will accept it when there are two panels that come to two opposite conclusions.
But wouldn't it be true, Mr. Sheridan, the reason I've asked about that is that our case law interpretation, we would not be bound, the Supreme Court, or us for that matter, to the Fourth Amendment decision-making of the U.S. Supreme Court if we found that our Constitution provided greater liberty.
The next one, number 9, we'll have that in there.
I see. Thank you.
The court then went on to say that roadside sobriety tests, on the other hand, are observations of the subject made by a police officer who is trained to discern clues of impairment and then makes this statement, but visual observation is no search at all. Just reading that particular sentence and where the quotes are in there should raise all sorts of red flags for whether that was taken out of context. The support for that they cite is Kylo versus United States. Kylo versus that, those words do in fact appear in Kylo versus United States when they're talking about whether a police officer can sit in a squad car across the street from someone's home and watch the home. And the answer was yes, they can do that. That's not a search. What happened in Kylo, however, was that they also used thermal imaging on the house, never entered the house, did it from the same place out on the street, and they found that that was in fact a search, and an illegal one because it was done without a warrant, and again, not a search for stuff. So in dismissing my argument that these field sobriety tests are in fact Fourth Amendment searches, the Vondracek court starts by citing authority that has been overturned, and then by citing, misquoting or taking a quote completely out of context from another case about visual observations being no search at all. While it is true that in traffic stop situations, the officer directs the subject to complete the actions from a position of authority, the subject is able to decline performing the requested tests, which is something that actually happened in this particular case, because people have the right under the Fourth Amendment not to participate in unwarranted searches. They don't have the choice if there's a warrant, but if there is no warrant and all they're looking for is consent, yes, indeed, people do have the right to decline to participate in unwarranted searches. And then they declare, after citing those little bits, that this isn't a search. Citing to a case that's been overturned, misquoting another case, and just merely stating the law of Fourth Amendment search, which is that you have no legal obligation to participate in an unwarranted one. And somehow that dismisses entirely the question of whether this is a Fourth Amendment search.
I understand your argument, but after Vondracek was decided, mm-hmm. this court also decided Messenberg, which, are you familiar with that case? It has to do with what standard is required for an officer to request a preliminary breath test.
Yes.
So in that case, this court held that reasonable suspicion is what's required for a preliminary breath test. I assume you would agree that a preliminary breath test is more invasive than an HGN.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see that case addressed in your brief, but given that this court has recently applied the reasonable suspicion standard rather than probable cause standard to a preliminary breath test, how, in your view, could we reach the result you're seeking consistent with Messenberg?
You couldn't do it consistent with Messenberg. You could do it and should do it consistent with McNeely and, in that particular case, Birchfield, because Birchfield said that that breath testing is different than blood and urine testing in the sense that it is a search incident to arrest. So the reason the warrant went away for breath testing, and right now, as you know, in Minnesota, we need warrants for blood tests, we need warrants for urine tests. The only reason that breath testing got left out of that is because it was considered by our Supreme Court to be a search incident to arrest. So if the search precedes the arrest and serves as a part of its basis, Cybran versus New York makes very clear, I believe the language is, it is axiomatic that a incident search cannot precede an arrest and serve as part of its justification. So you ask me, how can you do this? There are three United States Supreme Court decisions that directly address the question of when a breath test can be administered, none of which are consistent with Messenberg. So you must decide whether you're going to follow Messenberg or whether you're going to follow binding precedent rather than just precedent from other panels in this court. Binding precedent from the highest court in this land. And I don't envy you that choice, okay? But that's why you got the black robe. You can do the hard things, okay? But you can't ignore that you have to choose between either following McNeely, Birchfield, and Cybran, or following another panel's decision in Messenberg. Obviously, I think the court got this wrong. Not just the district court, but seven versions of this court have this wrong. Vondracek is, there's no other way to talk about it. It's just embarrassing to not even shepherdize the cases that you're using as the basis. I mean, if you're going to cite to Vondracek as the basis for denying Mr. Oboa's petition here, you are signing off on that type of research, right? The three judges who wrote it, staff attorneys allowed the citation of an overruled case to become the basis of the Vondracek decision, and how many times is this court going to reaffirm that mistake before someone says, hey, maybe we should come up with an alternative decision, and then maybe the Minnesota Supreme Court will take a look and Sheridan can stop bothering us. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for responding, you may approach when you're ready and identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Madeline Sheehy. I represent the respondent in this case, the Commissioner of Public Safety. There are two issues presented in this case. Appellant primarily focused on the second issue, whether the officer had probable cause to arrest appellant for DWI based on multiple objective indicators of impairment, including the clues of impairment observed during the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. Just to follow up on some of the questions asked during appellant's argument, I disagree with the contention that there is a choice to be made about whether to follow McNeely or Vondracek and Messenberg. This case is indistinguishable from Vondracek, with the exception of the fact that Messenberg was decided after Vondracek and bolstered the reasoning in Vondracek. Additionally, there was a preliminary breath test in Vondracek. The only field sobriety test administered in this case was a partial horizontal gaze nystagmus test. So I disagree with the contention that there's a choice to be made about choosing which precedent to follow. Because McNeely...
Counsel, and maybe you're about to get to this, but can you address appellant's argument that Vondracek relies on outdated and questionable Supreme Court authority when inciting Olmstead, and that that according to appellant, that should cause this court to revisit Vondracek?
I agree with appellant that the case cited in Vondracek is one of the cases is Olmstead. However, the reasoning in Olmstead and the reasoning in Vondracek is still sound. The distinction between the types of things that courts view as searches and as not searches. Here,
Well, and in fact, isn't the cite to Olmstead, I mean, the sentence says searches generally involve the collection of some physical evidence. It doesn't say searches always involve the collection of some physical evidence. I mean, I think that the court was citing it for the general statement that usually searches do involve the collection of some physical evidence. They're not citing Olmstead for the proposition that a search must involve the collection of physical evidence. That's not what Vondracek says.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree that the reasoning in that is that searches involve the collection of some sort of tangible physical evidence generally. And even Kylo, which was cited by appellant as overruling Olmstead, in that case, the search was across the street with surveillance and I can't remember if it was heat goggles or night vision, something along those lines. That is drastically different from what we're talking about here in a partial horizontal gaze nystagmus test where an officer holds up a stimulus and asks a driver to follow it with his eyes. Drastically different than the other types of searches that courts conclude to be full searches under the Fourth Amendment.
Ms. Sheehy, an interesting, as I recollect trial, DWI trials, you always have the officer as part of the testimony, with the exception of the PBT, statutorily cannot bring that up during the trial, but will testify as to how the defendant did on the field sobriety testing. So obviously it is evidence that is presented during the trial and often fairly convincing evidence. So at least on that level, it's a reasonable argument. Perhaps the HGN is a little more technical and that there's a distinction between that and just the observations of walking on a straight line and that sort of thing. But can you respond to that? It strikes me that on one hand, if it's not evidence of the underlying crime, then arguably it ought not to come in during a trial and you would start only later. Can you explain that distinction and why that really doesn't matter as it rises to this kind of broader issue?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would first point out that this is not a criminal case. This is an implied consent case, a civil case about the driver's license revocation.
All the case law, they overlap because of the statutory basis you can raise in an implied consent, and oftentimes I would hear them raised almost concurrently at a preliminary hearing.
Correct, Your Honor, and the issue in the implied consent case is whether there was probable cause to arrest for DWI and invoke the implied consent law. But with regard to your question, it's my position that field sobriety tests are not necessarily designed to detect incriminating behavior from people. The purpose of field sobriety testing is to either confirm or dispel an officer's suspicions that a driver may be impaired. That's what they're designed to do. When a driver comes across someone on the side of the road, has a conversation with them after a traffic stop, comes to believe that they may be impaired by alcohol, they put them through standardized field sobriety tests to verify whether or not that belief can be substantiated. There are people who are let go after performances on field sobriety tests. So that's not entirely the only reason.
Are there statistics on that, by the way?
Not that I have available to cite to you right now. I would imagine there are, but I don't have them available. I apologize.
And part of the reason I've read all this questioning in both parties seem to concede one is not obligated to do, which is part of the analysis of whether it's a search. It almost behooves individuals, it seems to me, never to say no all the time because it is going to be used ultimately. And so then all you would have, you'd still be arrested because of the bloodshot, watery eyes, I assume, and an odor of alcohol if it's alcohol related. But that would minimize the evidence at trial, obviously, to the testing that happens, most of the evidence, testing later and maybe driving conduct.
That's entirely true, Your Honor. People have the right to refuse to perform field sobriety tests, and people do. The appellant in this case did. He performed only a partial bit of the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, and then he told the officer that he was not going to be performing any additional tests. So that's why that is the only evidence from a field sobriety test that is before the court in this case. And that just bolsters, again, the comparison to Vondracek that it's really indistinguishable factually from the argument that was made there. And
do we even need to? Go ahead.
I think I was just going to ask the question that you're going to ask.
Do we even need to reach the Fourth Amendment question? Was there sufficient evidence prior to the HGN in this case that there would have been probable cause to arrest?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe the record supports a conclusion that there was probable cause to arrest appellant for driving while impaired before the horizontal gaze nystagmus test was administered. The traffic stop was for an equipment violation. However, upon approach, the officer observed that There was a strong odor of alcohol coming from appellant, that he had bloodshot, watery eyes, and that he had slurred speech. Appellant also admitted to drinking. In my brief, I cite the case of State versus Lottiser for the proposition that an admission to drinking plus minimal other indicators of impairment is sufficient for probable cause to arrest, and I believe that Lottiser supports the conclusion here that there was sufficient probable cause to arrest appellant for driving while impaired, absent the clues of impairment observed from the HGN test.
So if, in this case, the appellant had said, no, I'm not doing the HGN test, it's your, you would submit that the officer still could have arrested the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
Did the officer testify, by the way, that I think I read 4 of 6 clues, and then that's when the test ended, the HGN?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the officer opine whether a partial HGN is the same as a completed HGN in terms of supporting probable cause, or is it simply 4 clues from a partial HGN added to the previous as all part of the probable cause basis, if we were to consider the HGN at all?
I believe the testimony from the officer was that, and this is on page 12 of the transcript, that 4 out of 6 clues of impairment, which is what he observed from the appellant in this case, is what his training instructs him is indicative of impairment, impaired performance on an HGN test.
So it was irrelevant that he was not able to conduct the other two, or as long as he observes 4, the other two are irrelevant.
Well, probable cause is a totality of the circumstances analysis, so 2 additional clues would be relevant in the totality of the circumstances there, but the officer testified that 4 out of 6 clues based on his training is what you'll see for impairment.
And just to clarify, the other two weren't that they were in opposite to impairment, he didn't complete it because that's how it ended.
Yes, Your Honor.
There was two parts of the HGN, in other words, that might lead to clues that were left uncompleted.
Correct, Your Honor. The testimony from the officer was that the appellant was moving his head and not following the stimulus, and he was unable to complete the rest of the HGN test.
Thank you.
I'll address...
With regard to the first issue, and I appreciate going back to the HGN test, I appreciate the clarification on relevancy. I think that's a good point. But with regard to the initial stop, is there any reason why this court's decision in Beal doesn't control the analysis here? It seems pretty on point to me.
No, Your Honor, I agree that Beal does control the analysis here, and just as the argument that the appellant in Beal made was rejected by this court, appellant's argument here is similar and should likewise be rejected.
And that's because in the record, there's no dispute that not all 3 brake lights were working, only the middle one and the passenger side, if I recall.
Correct. According to the record in this case, the driver's side brake light was not illuminating when the brakes were applied, but the passenger side brake light was, in addition to the middle above the rear window.
And in fact, if I recall, the officer, before getting into the DUI investigation, asked him to use the left blinker, and it was blinking fast, and he testified that that's typical of a faulty light bulb for that particular.
Correct, Your Honor. The record makes clear that the officer told appellant the reason for the stop. Your driver's side brake light was out. Appellant said, well, I didn't think so. And then the officer instructed appellant, well, turn on your blinker. Sometimes if it blinks fast, that means there's a bulb not working. And the testimony was that he turned on the blinker and the blinking was fast, indicating that somewhere there was a bulb not functioning. So for those 2 reasons, and because the district court's factual findings were not clearly erroneous, and because it did not err in applying well-established law, this court should affirm. Unless there are any additional questions from the court, I would yield the remainder of my time.
Appears to be none. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you may reapproach and begin your rebuttal.
Thank you. Pen down. Thank you.
I often hear the court say that Missouri versus McNeely is only a case about blood testing. Missouri versus McNeely is a case about the Fourth Amendment and about what's permitted in a routine DWI investigation. The holding of Missouri versus McNeely is that there's nothing special about DWI investigations.
Do you agree with respondent that we don't need to reach the Fourth Amendment issue because there's already probable cause to arrest?
I do not. The testimony, if you're prepared to ignore the testimony of the officer and the findings of the district court, then I suppose you could do that and come up with your judgment for that of the officer in the court. But the fact is that the officer testified that while my client was seated in the car, all he had was evidence that my client had consumed alcohol before driving, which is not a crime for a person of my client's age. So
the officer also testify that the officer noticed Obawa's eyes were bloodshot and glassy, that the officer noticed a strong odor of alcohol, and that his speech was slurred. I think that's on page 9 of the transcript.
And he did, again, testify to that, and then on cross-examination acknowledged that he never met him, had no idea what his speech normally sounded like, no idea what the condition of his eyes are usually like at 11:30 at night. Again, excuse me.
But those are facts that can be considered in the probable cause determination, the officer's observations, correct?
Well, sure. And the officer acknowledged that that was evidence of consumption, not evidence of impairment. Okay? That's why he wanted to get my client out of the car. And acknowledged that the sole purpose of doing that was to conduct field sobriety tests so that he could gather physical evidence from my client's person to help him determine whether my client had consumed a legal amount of alcohol or an illegal amount of alcohol. He is conducting a search for evidence of criminal wrongdoing, which, as Your Honor noted, is the thing that they get to sit on the witness stand and talk all about.
But aren't the other factors that Judge Cochran was discussing, I mean, that's not evidence of drinking. Cops don't look at that as evidence of prior drinking. They generally look at those as consuming evidence over the legal limit.
But cops will always refer to that as evidence of intoxication, which is why I clarify on cross-examination that those are actually clues of consumption, not clues of impairment, which is why he wanted...
If you have one glass of wine, you're not going to exhibit those symptoms necessarily.
Who's
correctly.
Not? Right. But who's not? Right? That's the question.
But that's part of the training of the officers, correct, is that those are signs that you're over the legal limit as opposed to that you're under the legal limit.
But that wasn't his testimony. Okay? So if we're going to rely on his training told us that while seated in the car, and all of those things that you listed, he had evidence of consumption, that it was for the
consumption over the legal limit, though, correct?
Consumption. That the purpose of performing the tests was to determine whether my client had consumed a legal amount of alcohol or an illegal amount of alcohol. To move from consumption to impairment, that's why they do field sobriety tests. That is his...
Does our case law say that an officer needs to only observe one indicia of intoxication for there to be probable cause?
True.
And...
Well, not true, but it's a totality of the circumstances.
Well, yes, but one can support a finding of probable cause.
I won't split hairs with you on that one, okay? But this officer didn't testify.
It is a totality of the circumstances, but... Right. And case law has concluded that the type of, what this officer observed in terms of Obawa's physical state were consistent with common indicia of impairment, namely smelling alcohol, bloodshot and watery eyes, and slurred speech.
And then testified that to him, a trained officer, those things were evidence of consumption, and that it was for the purpose of determining whether he was impaired that he wanted to conduct the field sobriety test.
So in your view, that testimony means that the officer didn't have probable cause to find impairment only consumption without the HGN.
It requires you to substitute your judgment for the trained officer for you to refer to those in this case as evidence of intoxication, because the officer, the trained officer, indicated that they were evidence of consumption. I see that my time is up.
One other question.
Sure. Certainly may. Which means you can
answer
it as well.
I guess it's not up to me.
I'm sorry.
Not at all.
Just one quick question for you. Going back to the HGN test, and Judge Sleater asked some good questions about clarifying the nature of the test and what that there were only 4 of 6 clues that were observed. The other 2 were left uncompleted. Does that affect the analysis in terms of probable cause?
No, because the officer also testified that 4 is the decision point.
So right, okay, thank you.
And the district court, in its findings and conclusions at the end of the hearing, indicated that was his conclusion, is that the horizontal gaze nystagmus test was the evidence that that was of impairment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and the briefing. We will take the matter under advisement. Days. Have a good day.